Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning. You're tuned to
K-Boo-O-O-Project.
The time is now just after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. Our engineer is Tammy Hepteus.
And I'd like to take a moment to thank all the staff for working round the clock to keep the station running. Thank you to Tammy, Arthur, Celeste, Jenna, Janka, Asia, and anyone else who has been operating the board. We need this community radio station now more than ever. And thank you to all the other programmers and volunteers who are trying to work around this, who are working from home, who are recording with equipment they may not usually record with, like I and my guests are today. If you are not a member of KBOO, we are a member-supported station. You can become one by going to kboo.fm/donate. And now with the rest of today's Old Mole Variety Hour.
The Old Mole is a Monday morning political radio zine coming to you from an intersectional, socialist, feminist, anti-colonial, and anti-racist perspective. We take our name from Karl Marx's revolutionary image of the mole burrowing beneath the surface-level certainties of history to dig up the underlying social structures and ways of thinking that impede our progress toward a world in which everyone can achieve their fullest potential. We offer interviews, commentaries, analyses, cultural reviews, and introspection, not just to critique the world, but to champion radically democratic, egalitarian, and earth-honoring ways of living and thinking and organizing for a better society. Today's show starts out with Bill Resnick and Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. They discuss one of his most recent books, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, which considers the lives of jazz greats, the forces of racism they faced, and their efforts to free themselves from money men. You may have heard that Metro just announced that the convention center would be converted into a temporary houseless shelter for the duration of the pandemic, while down in LA people are seizing empty housing just to survive. One segment we'll hear today from the archive features Desiree Hellegers interviewing Seattle housing justice activists Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubinick about their work in the 1980s and 90s with Operation Homestead, breaking into and liberating abandoned or unused buildings for people to live in. Last week's show was cut a little short, so we're going to hear a poem Patricia Kohlberg was going to read, Barbara Kingsolver's The Great Barrier. To wrap up today's show, our Left in the Lost segment this month is led by Mike Snedeker, talking with Debbie Nathan. They'll be giving us an update about the situation at the border and its deeper legal implications. You can listen to today's show in its entirety or as shareable segments, or to find past shows at kboo.fm/oldmole. Find us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with comments, questions, ideas for the show, or to get involved. Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Gerald Horn on the political economy of jazz.
Hi, Gerald Horn. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for inviting me.
Gerald Horn's a black Marxist historian credited by Cornel West as one of the great historians of our times. He uses a Marxist lens to illuminate the black experience internationally and especially in this country, illuminates the forces that operated to suppress and exploit blacks from their entry as slaves 400 years ago. His many books indicate his great scope. Let me mention just a few of them, over 30 books. The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century North America and Caribbean, Fire This Time, that's on Watts, Class Struggle in Hollywood, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, that is Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and Paul Robeson, The Artist is Revolutionary, and that's just some of his books. Gerald Horn's a tireless and serious scholar and researcher. He teaches at the University of Houston. He practiced law while getting his history PhD. His almost latest book, it's for discussion today, Jazz and Justice, Racism, and the Political Economy of Music. Its footnotes stretch over 100 pages, but Jazz and Justice is no dry history. the lives of the people he explores, the incidents of their lives, his discussions of the forces they faced, his writing and Jazz and Justice. It's exciting, often surprising, a great introduction to the music and the artists and the ways of techniques of capitalists, big and small, to get away with murder. So, Gerald Horn, tell us about Jazz and Justice and why you wrote it, besides giving yourself a chance to listen to the music.
Well, first of all, I come from a musical family. My younger brother, Marvin Horn, is a well-known guitarist and musician. He's played all over the world. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which is an epicenter of this music. You might recall that Miles Davis, the celebrated trumpeter, was born and raised right across the river in Alton and East St. Louis. And there are numerous other musicians hailing from St. Louis, including the block on which I grew up on in St. Louis, where the Bowie brothers, Lester Bowie of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and his younger brother Joe Bowie, who played with my brother in many bands from the time that they were peewees. So this is the environment that I grew up in, and I've also been trying to tell different stories, as your introduction suggested, of the black experience in North America, beginning with the early stages of slavery, stretching all the way up to the present. And as you suggested, doing this book allowed me to listen to a lot of music and to refresh my recollection about the music that helped to shape my consciousness early on.
You know, I read a good deal of it, not some other parts, but I did know boxing a little bit, and I was surprised by how much the music business resembled boxing, the complete exploitation of black talent. Tell us about the exploitation of black talent in the music business during the great jazz period.
Well, point number one is that I'm glad you mentioned boxing. I'm doing a book on boxing as we speak.
Oh,
point number two is that a number of leading musicians happen to be boxers, including Miles Davis, who you might recall worked out as a boxer quite a bit, and the drummer Stan Levy, who actually was a professional boxer. I think that some of the requirements for being a musician are fungible with regard to being transferred to boxing. That is to say, quick reflexes, supple fingers, to name a few, and certainly with regard to drumming, very adept and adroit footwork. With regard to the business, it might be useful to say that the traditional story is that this music that we call jazz, which is a music that presupposes the mastery of certain instruments, not least keyboards, strings, horns, etc., percussion, of course, has its roots in New Orleans, although part of that story is skewed by the fact that if you begin to look at the history of this music, which oftentimes involves adept improvisation, inevitably you're drawn to New Orleans. But I think that's because of the fact not only that a number of leading musicians hail from New Orleans, such as the premier trumpeter Louis Armstrong, right down to the present, and the premier trumpeter Sellers, but also because a number of archivists at Tulane University in New Orleans, beginning in the 1950s, began to do interviews of older musicians, some of whom were born in the 1870s, and those oral histories point in the direction of New Orleans being the birthplace of this music. Perhaps if archivists and the librarians at the University of Memphis, which also challenges New Orleans as the birthplace of this music, had been as industrious as the archivists at Tulane, we'd be talking about Memphis as a birthplace, or even my hometown of St. Louis. If archivists at St. Louis University and Washington University in St. Louis had been more industrious, perhaps we'd be talking about St. Louis as a birthplace.
Could Chicago lay a claim to that title?
Its claim is not as firm as those of the cities along the Mississippi River.
Uh-huh.
But certainly, eventually, after this music takes off the latter part of the 19th century, Chicago quickly gains a reputation as being a citadel of this music. Now, with regard to the business aspects, it's difficult to separate the origins or even perhaps the present of this music we call jazz from organized crime. That is to say, organized crime figures oftentimes ran the clubs where this music was being played. In New Orleans, as you know, bordello oftentimes were a site for this music being played. And I'm afraid to say that organized crime figures were not necessarily equal employment opportunity champions, to put it mildly. On the other hand, as I talk about St. Louis in the 1920s, I point out that there is a battle royal taking place for control of this music between organized crime figures on the one hand, who wanted to exploit these mostly black musicians shamelessly, and Ku Klux Klan types who wanted to exclude them. There's an actual physical showdown between the two, with the former prevailing, and therefore the black musicians winning the dubious privilege of being exploited shamelessly as opposed to being excluded. There are a number of stories about musicians like Louis Armstrong, who I mentioned a moment or so ago, who in the 1930s went to Europe because he was fearful of his life because of the intrusion of organized crime into the business of running clubs. I also talk about how these musicians are exploited by those who you would think would not be so inclined. I mean, for example, the band leader and pianist and composer Duke Ellington, who some might regard as the premier musician in the history of the United States of America, his manager, Irving Mills, actually put his name, that is to say Mills' name, on some of Ellington's leading compositions, which means that today, 2020, that the descendants of the late Irving Mills are reaping the royalties of compositions penned by the late Duke Ellington. You should also know, and the book details this at some length, that club owners and record label owners were not adverse to trying to ply musicians with controlled substances, up to and including addictive drugs, assuming that this would make them more pliable and more subject to signing adhesion contracts, that is to say one-sided contracts, that would benefit capital as opposed to labor. And then there's the question of unions, which one thinks of as the ultimate protector of exploited labor. But with regard to these musicians, it was a bit more complicated than that, because oftentimes the Euro-Americans who control these unions saw these black musicians as unfair competition and therefore sought to keep them from being part of the union on the one hand. And then in the 1960s, when the walls of Jim Crow began to erode for reasons that need not detain us here, you saw that many of the so-called colored locals, the Negro locals of these musicians' unions, were swallowed whole by the larger so-called white locals. But this led to the destruction of records, the liquidation of real estate holdings of the so-called colored locals. And it also led to these larger so-called white-dominated locals then cutting deals with management and capital to the detriment of the black membership. So on the one hand, this story that I'm telling is a rather typical story of exploitation. But on the other hand, there's another story in this book about struggle and triumph over adverse conditions. It's a story of Charles Mingus and Max Roach are seeking to seize part of the means of production by producing their own music and excluding the vampires and vultures that traditionally control this music. And it's a story of both triumph and tragedy.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole on Cable Radio, talking to Gerald Horn. He teaches history. He writes books, over 30. We've been talking about his book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. So far, we've discussed how so many great, talented black musicians, many groups and sources and ways of insult and suppression and pacification and exploitation by the music moguls, big and small, and also apparently by the musicians' unions. I didn't know that story. And on the other side, they did fight back. You just suggested that. Let's get into that. You pointed out that, you know, the cities that take credit earlier in our interview. My sense is a lot of the great jazz musicians were people who their formative years were spent all over the country in one or another black ghettoized neighborhood and developed their music there, sometimes in the churches, and then they became really proficient and did interesting things, and they were attracted to going to these cities. It seems to me that music really comes out of localities and neighborhoods and people supporting one another and looking for ways of finding work and income that might be much better than just doing service work in hotels or, you know, hauling bricks.
Well, I would say that a major theme in this book we're discussing is the fact that from its inception, many of these musicians were working overseas, not only in Western Europe. We all know about the sojourn of Charles Yardberg Parker of Kansas City, Kansas, in Europe, or Miles Dewey Davis in France, but also Tokyo. Art Blakey, the drummer, Ron Carter, the bassist, spending quite a bit of time in Tokyo. And also Dexter Gordon, the lanky saxophonist, spending time in Copenhagen. Or Art Farmer, spending time in Vienna. Ironically enough, many of these black musicians received a much fairer hearing and much better treatment overseas than in the land of their birth. And certainly this sojourn overseas helped to keep this music alive, because there were also record companies overseas that pressed discs that could then be sold all over the world. It was a real lifeline for many of these musicians. I shudder to think what would have befallen these musicians if they had just been stuck in the wilderness of North America.
I'm really a Charlie Mingus fan, not that I know very much, but I love the music because it's so democratic, because everybody plays, and individual soloists then break out of the larger orchestra and get a minute or two or three of some really fine riff with all the other players cooperating in the background to highlight it. And everybody gets their chance, everybody speaks, and it's a conversation. Some pieces can be played very, very differently. It seems to me really just so wonderful to hear. I have the sense that the musicians who did jazz were very supportive of one another, helped one another out, joined with them, went into jam sessions and worked out all kinds of very complex kinds of conversations, musical conversations. You talked about the struggle by black musicians to form unions and to cooperate. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly this question of cooperation is essential to an understanding of this music. But once again, it's a checkered picture. I spent a good deal of time in this book talking about the travails of women musicians in particular, who oftentimes face discrimination on the bandstand, in the clubs, oftentimes being derided by critics who wonder why they might take up, for example, a bass fiddle as an instrument. So certainly there was cooperation in terms of building unions, in terms of working out complex musical equations. But at the same time, of course, just as you had discrimination against musicians of African ancestry, you had discrimination against women, particularly women of African ancestry. And this, too, I'm afraid to say, was a hallmark of this music we call jazz.
You know, you really are a scholar. I run on the cheerleader line sometimes about things that I don't know really well. I'm sure that weakened the movement quite a bit and weakened the whole body of, especially of black talent.
That is true.
One thing that we haven't discussed is the state and how the state operated with black musicians, especially those who were critical in any way. Why don't you tell the story of Eddie Palmieri?
Well, it's not just Eddie Palmieri and the difficulty he had as a musician of Puerto Rican ancestry and his running up against anti-communists, anti-Castro Cubans who were threatening his livelihood. It's also the fact that these musicians were confronting a state that was basically an apartheid state that imposed and implanted and enforced apartheid-type laws. I mean, Jim Crow was not just a matter of custom. It was a matter of state practice enforced through the law and through the courts and through legislatures. And it took a mighty international force, not to mention a mighty domestic movement, to finally erode the innards of this hateful, spiteful system. But this book talks about how musicians confronted the state, an apartheid state, which was determined to impose second-class citizenship upon them.
Gerald Horn, thanks so much for talking to us, and now you can get back to your book on boxing, which is number 34 or something. I'm sure it'll be as illuminating as the others. So thanks a lot.
Thank you for inviting me.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.
listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Charlie Parker playing Now's the Time. Before that, Bill Resnick and Gerald Horn were talking about his book, Jazz and Justice, The Political Economy of the Music. Later in the show, The Left and the Law will be giving us an update about the border, legal cases, and political consequences. Up next, we hear a selection from our archives featuring Desiree Heliger's interviewing Seattle housing justice activists Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubenik about their work in the 80s and 90s with Operation Homestead, breaking into and liberating abandoned or unused buildings for people to live in.
I'm speaking today with Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubenik of Operation Homestead, which was a movement in Seattle from the late 1980s to the early 1990s. And Ginger and Bob, do you want to tell us a little bit about the organizing work of Operation Homestead and how you got involved?
Sure, I'll start. Operation Homestead was a group of activists, social service providers, religious leaders, and homeless people that came together in Seattle in about 1987. So at that time, there was a significant increase in homelessness in Seattle, as across the country. And there was a really clear connection for us between buildings being emptied for development in downtown Seattle and the number of people living on the street. So it started as sort of a small group, mostly of sort of housing activists, young people, people that worked. There's a tenants union here, the Tenants Union of Washington State, whose main office is in Seattle. So there were staff members. I was a staff member of the tenant union. So there were staff members of that organization. But then there were also, there had been social services popping up to serve homeless people, like shelters and some healthcare providers. And a lot of those people also became involved. And there was, I think, a relatively significant church component. There were church leaders who had opened their basements to homeless people or had meal programs, and there was a lot of discontent that this problem was increasing and increasing, and there didn't seem to be any decent response to that on the part of the city. So this group of people got together and came up with sort of a simple philosophy, which was there are many vacant buildings, there are far too many vacant buildings, and there are lots and lots of homeless people, and we should just open those vacant buildings and let the homeless people live inside them.
I arrived in town in 1988, left school, and I was working as a carpenter, and I moved to Seattle, and I came across a flyer talking about tearing down the boards and opening up housing for homeless folks. At that point, there were a lot of vacant single-room apartments in the downtown core that were being all boarded up. And, you know, in contrast to the number of people living on the streets, it sort of formulated its own question pretty obviously there. You know, the flyer just made a lot of sense to me. And as somebody who had some basic skills at building work and the idea of engaging homeless people to open up this housing, it just made sense.
And so how did you select buildings to occupy?
You know, over the course of the years, I think there were probably six different buildings. You know, as different people got involved in the organization, you know, I think a couple of things stepped forward. What was available, what buildings looked appropriate, what was visible and in an appropriate location, and frankly, what we could get our hands on. At the time, there had been a couple of ordinances that were passed in town that spoke to landlords' obligations to maintain their housing. There was the Downtown Housing Downtown Housing Maintenance Ordinance,
yeah.
And the Housing Preservation Ordinance. The DHMO spoke to a landlord's obligation to keep a building functional if it was practical to, right? Not to just hold on to it speculatively and tear it down when a better opportunity showed up. And so that was a reasonable, logical stepping off point for the organization. Like, this building's functional, there are people who need it, let's just tear down the boards and move in. And we, you know, clean this up and hold the landlord responsible for using it responsibly.
I guess I would add that we were not looking for just actions. We were not looking to tear down the boards, have the police show up, and be removed. That didn't happen most of the time. But we were looking at buildings that we could reasonably move people into quickly. So we weren't looking at buildings that were in just horrible shape. We were looking at buildings that could be made sort of reasonably habitable, but with our own work.
It's sweat equity.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the specific actions, some of the occupations, and some of the logistical problems that you might have encountered, some of the challenges?
Yeah.
So I think the first most successful occupation was that of the Orion Court apartments, and that all of these had various levels of involvement of people on the street. Whoever came to the demonstration would get involved in most cases, and so that made it a little tricky to plan for, but it also gave a lot of really inspired energy to the actions. So the Orion Court, I remember a couple of the planning sessions where there had been previous takeovers, and somebody new to one of the meetings said, you know, well, what if they don't kick us out after a couple hours? And there was, I think, general laughter ensued after that. But in fact, we ended up staying there for 5 days. And figuring out what to do both with ourselves and with the building became a much richer conversation there. So people started off immediately pushing brooms and cleaning up the debris in the building, and in fact finding, I think, you know, functional dressers, beds in the rooms. They were somewhat furnished and usable. But then after a couple of days, you know, there wasn't power turned on, so we went to a rental facility around town, and we ended up borrowing a generator and an electrician stringing some lights to make the space safe, and people chipping in the skills that they had. And
we actually, I don't know if you remember this, but we actually passed the fire code inspection. Do you remember that?
Yes.
The fire department showed up and said, you can't be in here. It's not safe. And we said, well, what do we have to do? And they gave us a list of things. You know, you had to have exit signs, and I don't remember what they all were.
Yeah, some fire extinguishers and lights that stayed on all the time. And those, we ended up having a punch list that we were able to satisfy there. And then I think some real magic moments involved the people from the streets who got involved and sort of their energy and their pride in doing the cleanup and leading tours and having some knowledge about the actions. And city council members came down. I remember police officers coming around and checking things out. And there were rules that we had about, you know, safe conduct in the building, including no weapons. And one of the folks who was staying there informing the police that he had to leave his weapons at the door, which was soundly refused. But amused, you know, everyone was amused by the idea, and that's a very memorable moment.
Well, and it maybe raises the question of what is the relationship between Operation Homestead and kind of the some of that organizing energy that it helped mobilize, and you know, Seattle's really thriving tent city movement now with its self-governing philosophy. So that's, yeah, maybe not a conversation that we have time for today, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you see as some of the long-term contributions of the organizing work.
Well, that tent city group had its roots at the same time. I think they're very long-lived and come from the same seeds.
There are a lot of people that became politicized through Operation Homestead that then had careers, long either, you know, activism or professional careers in housing and homelessness in Seattle, and have had a big influence on services and policy in Seattle.
Can you talk a little bit about specific units that might have been preserved or other kind of gains in terms of actual housing units?
There were four major takeovers and two less major takeovers. We didn't we got evicted quickly, and the movement was not quite as strong then. But there were four really significant ones, two of which we stayed in the building for quite a while, one for 5 days and one, I'm not sure how long the Pacific Hotel was.
I think that was somewhere around a week.
So of those four, three of the buildings were saved and renovated, purchased by nonprofits, and renovated with public money that was made available, at least partly, if not wholly, because of the political pressure around the activism and the takeover of the buildings.
Is that a specific agreement that in exchange for leaving, a certain number of units would be preserved?
No. We got evicted. So the ones we got evicted quickly from, you know, it was very sort of unceremonious, like they were stronger than we, and that was the end of that.
But because of the, I think, the clear message, the clear appropriate message to the obvious problem, it has resounding, it resonates with people, and there was a lot of public support. You know, I think many people articulated some of the dangers that were unleashed by moving a lot of homeless people into an ungoverned building 24 hours a day for a series of days, and that is, I think, not to be minimized. But taking action, taking direct action to resolve an obvious and deep problem, I think it makes sense to people, and it resonated even after we were out of the building.
It sounds as if, you know, it really raised a lot of public awareness, and the fact that people were willing to go as far as they did in order to try to secure housing must have helped motivate a lot of other people to try to address the
issue. Yeah, I guess just to follow up on that and your question about exactly how were these gains achieved, what Bob was saying about the conversation that was created by this, the elevation in the public dialogue, the increase in the public conversation, and the amount of political pressure that was created set the stage to make it possible to save these buildings. And that felt good for the activist group that these buildings were saved. It wasn't a direct negotiation that we were involved in, but it would not have happened without us and would not have happened without the political pressure that we created. But then there was also benefits that we didn't even know about. Washington State has one of the healthiest housing trust funds in the country. That's a statewide funding program for low-income housing. And that was funded in 1991 in Olympia, in our legislature that, like Oregon, has, you know, we have pockets of conservatism in the state and we have pockets of liberalism in the state. But the trust fund was funded by the state legislature in 1991, and I think that is largely because of the political pressure that was created by the activism around abandonment and homelessness in Seattle.
Well, great. Thank you so much. I've been talking with Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubenik about Seattle's Operation Homestead. Thank you. And this has been Desiree Helligers with the Old Mole Variety Hour. Yeah.
listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. The music we just heard was Donald Byrd's Lover Come Back to Me from his Off to the Races album, something I grew up listening to. Donald Byrd on trumpet and Pepper Adams on baritone sax there. Before that, Desiree Hellegers was talking with Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubenik, Seattle housing justice activists, about squatting homes with Operation Homestead in the 1980s and 90s. Now we turn to something that got cut off from last week's show. Patricia Kohlberg is going to read Barbara Kingsolver's poem, The Great Barrier.
I'm going to read a poem by Barbara Kingsolver entitled The Great Barrier. The poem was inspired by the burning of Notre Dame nearly 1 year ago, which Kingsolver renders into an ironic commentary on the devastation of global warming. The Great Barrier. The cathedral is burning, absent flame or smoke. Stained glass explodes in silence, fractal scales of angel, damsel, rainbow, parrot, charred beams of blackened coral lie in heaps on the sacred floor. White stones fallen from high places, spires collapsed, crushing sainted turtle and gargoyle octopus. Something there is in my kind that cannot love, a reef, a tundra, a plain stone breast of desert ever quite enough. A tree perhaps once recomposed as splendid furniture, a forest after the whole of it is planed to posts and beams and raised to a heaven of earnest construction in the name of Our Lady. All Paris stood on the bridges to watch her burning, believing a thing this old, this large and beautiful must be holy and cannot be lost, and coral temples older than Charlemagne suffocate unattended, bleach and bleed from the eye, the centered heart. Lord of leaves and fishes, lead me across this great divide. Teach me how to love the sacred places, not as one devotes to one who made me in his image and is bound to love me back. I mean, as a body loves its microbial skin, the worm, its nape of loam, all secret otherness forgiven, love beyond anything I will ever make of it. That was the Barbara Kingsolver poem called The Great Barrier.
Wish I was a lizard in the spring. Wish I was a lizard in the spring. Cause if I was a lizard in the spring, I'd make those mountains sing.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was another part of the track that our show opened with, a recording that Zindu Zagoren made with DJ Rupture of our theme song, Mole on the Ground. To wrap up our show, we turn to The Left and the Law, this time being led by Mike Snedeker. He talks with Debbie Nathan about what's going on at the border.
Good morning. This is Mike Snedeker. I'm here to interview Debbie Nathan. Debbie Nathan is an award-winning journalist, especially known for covering the border, problems with the border, since writing a book called Women and Other Aliens when she lived in El Paso, and then 30 years ago. Then she moved to New York for a couple of decades and is now back on the border doing award-winning work for Intercept and other publications about life on the border. And Debbie, we are particularly interested in what's happening with COVID-19 and border conditions where people are jammed together so closely.
Yeah, you know, there is not so far a lot of reported cases here. There are about 8 in El Paso, and there's less than a handful in Juarez, which is our sister city. But I think there's a sense, particularly in Juarez, that things can get out of control really, really quickly because as your listeners might know, there's a program called Remain in Mexico, which under the Trump administration started it back in January a year ago, so it's been a little bit over a year now, where people, asylum seekers who come up from Central America, are not allowed to come into the United States, which is really their right, you know, to make an asylum claim. So now they're sent back to Mexico, and they're sent to border cities like Juarez. Juarez is one of them, which are very, very dangerous for these folks for many reasons. For one, they're targeted by criminal cartels as people who are, you know, easily identifiable. I mean, a Cuban on the street in Juarez really sticks out. They dress a little differently. They speak with different accents. And that's true for everybody who's in this program, includes Cubans and Central Americans and Brazilians, too. So they really stick out, and they're just constantly attacked and kidnapped for ransom and used as cash registers here on the border. So they live in, many of them live in shelters, and I have a lot of experience inside these shelters. They're very, very crowded. They're dirty. They're old and decrepit. And people are sick in these shelters, including the kids. You know, everybody has sort of low-grade constant illnesses because of the crowding. And so this makes them really vulnerable to the COVID-19 virus. And so people are sort of waiting to see how that plays out. And the situation is even worse over in Brownsville, which is on the other end of Texas, Brownsville and the sister city Matamoros, where there are 2,000 people living in this, I mean, I hesitate to even call it a camp. It's just this ticky-tack tent city that's right on the river in the mud. And there's no formal refugee organization. It's all sort of run by volunteers to the extent that there's food and medical care. That's all volunteer, mostly coming from the other side, from the U.S. And those people are in extreme vulnerability for COVID-19. So things have gotten even worse the last week or so because the United States has closed the border to non-U.S. citizens and non-permanent legal residents. So, you know, it's weird. It's a little hard to imagine if you're not here, but these are sister cities, and culturally there's constant back and forth normally between these sister cities on both sides of the border, all the way from Texas to California. And so if you close the border, you make it impossible for people to come over to see their families, to come over and get medical care. And the irony is that there's almost no reported COVID on the Mexico side yet. As I mentioned, in Juarez, I believe there are about 3 cases right now. And yet over on this side, there's far more, you know. So you have the Trump administration saying that we're closing the border to protect the United States from the South. And when you look at, I mean, you can look at maps of where COVID is, and there's very little of it in Latin America now. And, but Trump is talking about protecting the United States from people from the South, you know, which is sort of a classic idea that these are people that are dirty and infected. And in fact, probably the real danger is people going from the United States to Mexico, which is still happening.
Do we have any reason to believe that Mexico has a grasp of what's going on, that has testing abilities, and that we really know?
Well, Mexico is in the same situation, I think, as a lot of communities in the United States, including the one I live in El Paso. There's almost no tests available. I'm hearing reports here in El Paso of people that are getting really sick and they can't be tested. In order to even start to get a test, you have to first go to your doctor. If you even have a doctor, 30% of people here are uninsured, and there is a doctor shortage. But if you manage to have a doctor or find a doctor and you can pay for that doctor in some way, whether it's your insurance deductible, your insurance, or you're just a private ability to pay, and this is a very, very poor city. All right, so go to your doctor charges you or your insurance for a flu test, which has to come out negative, and a strep test, which has to come out negative, and you can't go to the health department and get a free COVID test unless you've done all that, which can cost many hundreds of dollars. And so, you know, it's funny. I mean, we're pretty much in the same situation as Mexico over here. And, I mean, Mexico probably hasn't recognized most of the COVID that exists in Mexico, just like the United States hasn't recognized most of our COVID. but in many communities, it's worse than other communities. And I would say El Paso, or these border communities, at least in Texas, are probably in very bad shape. I'm talking about the U.S. side now. So the difference between one side of the border and Mexico and trying to figure out what's going on, I don't think is very much.
Okay. So you're saying that in Juarez, people are being sent there from all over the border who have come from places in Central America, from Africa, from Cuba, from wherever. They're all these people who are neither Mexicans nor citizens of the U.S. are being concentrated in camps in particular cities along the border?
No, there's one city, Matamoros, which is just right across from Brownsville at the tip of Texas by the Gulf of Mexico. There is a camp there. There's no camps in other places. But there are these dirty, crowded shelters. I mean, Juarez is full of them. They're usually run by churches, and they're very well-meaning. I mean, there was a shelter I hung out at for a very long time because I was working with a family trying to get them through their MPP process. They were here for a year. And the kids, they had two little girls. One was six, one is three. And those girls were constantly sick. It was just one crisis to another because it's just, you know, there's 30 people in this very crowded, decrepit place. It's dirty. It's really hard to keep clean. And, you know, everybody was on top of each other. There were 10 people in a little room, like the size of a small bedroom in the United States. So there was one family with four people and another family with four people, including kids, and then two other people all living in this one room. And so the kids were always sick, which shows you that this flu stuff is all normal flu, right? It's just in the air at these places all the time. That family actually gave up on their claim after a year. They were so worn down and so sick. And so it's a long story, but they ended up going to Puebla, which is way, way far south in Mexico, you know, near Mexico City. And they're resettling in Puebla. But it's interesting because they just arrived in Puebla and they're telling me that they're afraid to go outside because even down there, that far south of the border, that far south of the United States, everybody's staying at home. I mean, people in Mexico are also very worried about COVID-19.
Wow. Well, social distancing sounds like a luxury.
I think social distancing is a luxury for many, many people, not just in the United States, but also in Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's happening? Are there any asylum cases at all being heard now?
So there's this sort of revolt in the immigration court because judges and prosecutors and the employees, like the guards, you know, the people that lead people into the courtroom, they are really worried about getting infected. And in fact, there, I believe, I can't remember what city it is, I believe in Denver, there's an infected judge. And I think there's some infected people up in New Jersey that work in the courts. And so a lot of the courts actually have been formally shut. Like in Seattle, the immigration courts are shut. A lot of other courts, like here in El Paso, well, in most courts, the government is insisting on keeping these courts open for what are called detained people. Detained people looking for asylum are usually in ICE detention. But weirdly enough, down here in El Paso, the people that are in the Migrant Protection Protocol, the MPP, where they've been booted back into Mexico, they're considered detained. And so they show up at 4 a.m. for their hearings at the bridge, and they're bussed in on these crowded vans into El Paso, into the immigration court, and where they're put in these tiny rooms, again, like maybe the size of 3 little bedrooms in the United States, and there'll be like 30 people in these courts, 30 asylum seekers in the courts, you know, the judge, the translator, guard, like, they're very, very crowded. And basically the court personnel, including the judges, are freaking out. The judges' union has called for the complete closure of courts. And so has the union for the prosecutors, you know, and then the lawyers who represent these people. Like, they've all gotten together and demanded the closure of the courts. But the government so far has just ignored this and insisted that people go into immigration court. It's really, really scary.
Well, Debbie, on that scary note, I really appreciate this Polaroid snapshot of life now on the border in the time of the COVID virus. Thank you much, Debbie.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Joe. That's Mike Snedeker talking on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank our guests, Mike Snedeker with Debbie Nathan, Bill Resnick with Gerald Horn, Desiree Helligers with Ginger Siegel and Bob Kubinek, to Patricia Kohlberg reading Barbara King Solver's The Great Barrier, and thanks again to the amazing staff of KBOO that is keeping this beacon alive in these very strange times.
You can listen to today's show in its entirety or as shareable segments, or to find past shows at kboo.fm/oldmole. Find us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with comments, questions, ideas for the show, or to get involved.
Tune in next week for more news, reviews, commentary, and interviews from the Old Mole's Radical Perspective.